I have been reminded in the week that we've had our daughter and grandchildren with us that there are mothers and fathers in this world whose patient care of their children is exemplary. It's a little difficult to think of this young lady who only a few years ago was hanging around my knees being such a capable and thoughtful mother. And we wish, as we think about that, that across this world of ours, all parents were so concerned and so dutiful and so unselfish. On April the 19th of this year, the federal building in Oklahoma City was blown almost apart by an intentionally set bomb. In the middle of that building was a child care center. And if we were moved by the brutalized bodies of adults that were taken from that wreck, we were especially touched by the bodies of little children. But most of the real child abuse is not so dramatic in our society. In a materialistic, self-centered world that glorifies the here and now, in a world that is essentially amoral and godless, even while it practices all kinds of religious rituals, there's not much hope for children who need far more than mere safety and things. In Genesis chapter 42 and verse 22, not far from where our brother was reading today, and as an extension of the same story of Joseph and his brothers, when the brothers are found in the presence of Joseph unknowingly, and he has required of them to give true faith as to their honesty by leaving one of the brothers in prison in Egypt while they return to their father's house. And Reuben is moved on this occasion as he thinks about Joseph lost, and now the possibility of a second brother gone. And we for the first time know that Reuben had a deep concern about Joseph. And Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not say to you, do not sin against the child, the lad, and you would not hear? Therefore also, behold, his blood is now required." In other words, consequences come because we are indifferent to the needs of children. And I want to talk to you today about child abuse in the extremes. And that is to say, we tend to vacillate between two opposing poles. No screen. How about that? Well, let me tell you. This was going rather well till that happened. I could blame Brother Ed today for not taking care of me. He usually comes up and asks me if I'm going to use the overhead. But, you know, that gives me an opportunity to make an object lesson. You're always responsible to take care of your own needs. And I should have been more thoughtful. Now we're in business. Extremes of treatment toward children. Both of which, well, sometimes we think that the opposing and opposite kind of treatment would certainly be the right treatment for a child, turns out to be something that's destructive. Neglect and deification. We swing wildly between these two extremes in our treatment of children. Children need a great deal more than just some material comforts. We're responsible as their parents, as those who are strong enough physically, experienced enough in life, and intellectually mature enough to do it, to provide for these children that we, either by our heedlessness or by our intentions, bring into the world. So the Apostle Paul said, who never had a child but understood this relationship, he said, the fathers ought to lay up for the children and not the children for the father. And he was speaking about his responsibility to those in Corinth whom he had first taught and brought to spiritual birth. He said, it's my obligation and I accept it gladly to make provision for you. I have no resentment about that. And so parents ought not to have any resentment nor feel a sense of burden when they have brought children into the world and those children present responsibilities to them. A child needs food and clothing, certainly. And it is very apparent when parents do not provide this elemental kind of need. But they need more than food, clothing, and housing. They need love. And not only do they need love, but they need discipline or training. And they need encouragement and protection. And all these things need to be given within the framework of training in the knowledge of God. A child needs to know who he is. And that represents far more than being able to present a birth certificate. A child needs to know who he is transcendently, why he's in the world, and what direction he needs to take while here. And that becomes the responsibility of the parent. And when those things are not done, this is a most serious kind of negligence. And I believe a lot of child abuse is the product of simply that. Negligence. Too busy about other things that press. And by the way, in that connection, there are a lot of things that will press on you and make you think you could never escape these and that you don't have time to deal with your children. But the truth of the matter is, you just must deal with them. They are living beings, growing beings. They are not static. They will not be put on hold somewhere and told to keep their place until you can get back to them. As one mother wrote years ago, and I will always remember the poem, children don't wait. There is a narrow slit in life to give them what they need, and failing that, the moment does not come again. So we need to cherish and soberly regard every moment in our lives with our children. Deification is the opposite of neglect. We don't neglect them. We put them on a pedestal. And I've seen that, and you have too. Colossians 3 verse 5 says about covetousness that it is idolatry. In other words, the love of things, the deification of things, the elevation of things, the position of being all important, and we can make our children that. Now, I know some people think you can't do too much for your children. But the truth is, you can. And in swinging from the opposite extreme of neglect and indifference and carelessness to a constant attention to them is a mistake. And a bad one. But sometimes we think that our little darlings cannot be guilty of any kind of wrong. And we'll even elevate their inappropriate behavior to the position of delightful, amusing. Well, if they lie a bit, that's just creative imagination. I understand. that sometimes there is imagination in children who like to talk about things they've seen and people they have visited with, and you know they are nothing but the figment of a child's imagination. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about when they began to truly dissemble and not tell the truth about things that are important to their character. And we just wipe that off and act as though it's of no consequence. And the rod of correction collects dust somewhere. And we look at this as being especially attentive to and dedicated to the child. Parents who give their children everything they ask for. Which reminds us of a set of parents in a school conference room talking to the school administrators about terrible misbehavior. The child is incorrigible, rebellion against everything. And they said, we cannot understand this. We have given him everything he wants. Well, there should have been some sort of logical connect there. You cannot do that. In fact, may I say to you that's the easiest thing to do in some ways. But it's wrong from its foundation. We give them daily sacrifices. Here is a case in point that I know goes far beyond the bounds, but it illustrates what I want to point out. A high school girl who wanted to wear a topless gown to the high school prom was refused permission by the school authorities, and her father took the case to the state Supreme Court and won. And the girl did just exactly what she proposed to do. Now, it's inconceivable to me in what state of this union such a thing might happen. But it illustrates in the extreme when parents decide that whatever a child wants, that's what a child ought to have. And I might say to you, that some of us operate from the position that whatever I want, that's what I want to have. And that America is about freedom. Absolute, untrammeled freedom. And whatever you want to do, you just do that. That's your right. And whatever the consequence may be on others, that's something they have to deal with. Your child is neither angel nor devil, but made in the image of God with the power and the need to choose between the right and the wrong and between heaven and hell. And if that is to be the case, and if they are to choose well and wisely, it will be because they have been trained and taught what that might be. You can honor your children too much. There is an illustration of that in the Old Testament. In the case of Eli, who was the next to the last judge, I suppose one might say, Israel. And you recall that Samuel was the little boy born to Hannah who had prayed for a child, and that she said if he would give her a son, she would give him to him, to the Lord. And so he came as a little child soon after he was weaned and worked in the house of Eli. But Eli's own sons were ungodly. They did truly wicked things as priests. Eli was the high priest. And they did truly wicked things as priests. And the scripture says, God says in 1 Samuel 2:29, that Eli honored his children above God. He put his children in the place of God. Now, that is not to say that Eli never remonstrated with them about their behavior in the third chapter, verses 22 to 25, you've got a conversation that he had with them. Why do you do these things? These are wrong things. And I can imagine many parents who have done the same thing with their children, but at last don't ever follow through. Never bring any kind of consequence to that kind of behavior. Of course, in many ways, it was too late for Eli because his sons were grown men.
And he had deified them and put them in a place of honor above God. And Jesus warns about this as well in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 37 when he says that whosoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Is this possible? It is absolutely possible. Someone has said that people don't do wrong usually for themselves, but they will do wrong and compromise all kinds of moral principles for their children. Beware of that. Things that you would not have tolerated in your own life will not even do it now. We as parents often tolerate and yield to, just like Eli, in our children. We'll say a few words of reproof. We will say something like, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to be involved in that kind of activity? But then that's the end of the matter, and we'll even bankroll and provide what's necessary for it to happen. Well, let's turn to another case of child abuse in extremes. There's literal child abuse. We were horrified by the story of the young mother in South Carolina who put her two children in an automobile and sent it into a lake where they were forthwith, as she could well have known, drowned. Why did she do that? I'm not sure that any of us have the answer. It seems such a cold, heartless, callous thing for a mother to do. I don't know. We've rather treated fatherhood with less consideration. We are not so surprised about what fathers may do. We ought to be. But when mothers do it, who are the nearest to little children, who nurture them and sucker them at their breast, and then to see a mother do that, we're startled by it. And to read stories about parents who had a child they chained to a bed at age 11 and gave one bowl of oatmeal a day, that's horrifying. And children being burned, or their bodies so beaten that when they finally are taken for medical attention, there's hardly a bone in their body that hasn't been broken somewhere. Why does this happen? Selfishness. At last, selfishness. Children demand time. Children get in the way. Children are an inconvenience. Children are a burden. Many times. And finally, if parents are so lacking in all principle, no training in the knowledge of God or of what God has said in His Word, nothing to restrain, and all they do is to feel the frustration and the inconvenience that children bring, and they lash out. I dare say that there are not many cases of premeditated murder of children. But they get choked or brutalized, head battered, and suddenly they're dead. And the parents are trying to hide the body or do something to try to disguise what actually happened. It's bad. But I want to say to you that selfishness is a powerful force. And people whose lives are wrapped up in themselves will do some horrific things to children. But, you know, there's a subtler form of child abuse here. And that's an insufficient discipline. Child abuse by default. Child abuse by neglect. I raise the question here why people don't discipline their children. And I'm
suggesting to you that in many, if not most cases, it's selfishness again. It takes time to discipline.
Because discipline means what? Training.
It has within it the word disciple.
Have you ever thought of that?
And discipling someone means to train, to nurture, to guide in a direction chosen. There's a plan in it. It's not harum scarum. It's not random kind of activity. It is with purpose and with thought and with direction that this discipline is applied. In other words, the child who is disciplined truly is a child whose parents has a dream for that child. Parents who have a vision of what that child can be, and they want it to be, and they long for it to be, and they invest themselves in that very direction. I think a lot of parents don't have a clue as to what they want their children to be. Stay out of jail, maybe that'd be a base idea. I don't want them scandalizing me. I don't want their names appearing in the paper with who got in trouble from breaking the law. I don't want that to happen. And we imagine that one day they'll marry, there'll be grandchildren, and of course we'll enjoy that in the moments when we want to enjoy that. But how do you get there, and what kind of people they're going to be, and what moral and spiritual principles will sit inside their innermost being and guide them, that's something we have not considered much for ourselves, and we don't have any ability or inclination to give such a heritage to our children. That is abusive. I know you didn't intend it to be. But nonetheless, the consequence of selfishness is always the same. And the cause of all this, let me be simplistic, as I'd be accused of being. But I think we're almost ready to accept this. Almost ready to believe that perhaps there are some things that government cannot fix, that social programs cannot relieve, and that things that happen inside a home at last take their toll in the broad society. And what we're suffering is not a consequence of failed government programs, but the consequence of human failure, individual failure, parental failure in this society. We're paying the price of being selfish, of saying as we did through the 70s and the 80s, I need to find myself. I need to fulfill myself. I need to be what I need to be. And other people need to understand that. My husband needs to understand it. My wife needs to understand it. My children need to understand it. And this philosophy, which was blind and stupid from the beginning, that attended all this, and that was that if I am happy, then everybody else will be all right too. Selfishness. That's what it is. And we are selfish because we have not come into contact with the transcendent God who is greater than us all, and whose very majesty can sweep us into a sense of our own smallness and dependence and fragility, so that we are awakened to the fact that we need Him. Not just to find a job or to get some sick loved one well, but to know what life is about and to become what He intended us to be when we were created. We need to have reverence for God. And I want to suggest to you that it has a practical manifestation. And that is, we do what He says. And we don't sit around and rationalize about it with the God who made us. You don't say to that God, as the Apostle Paul speaks of it in Romans, why did you make me this way? We are in no position to have an argument with the one who's the ground of all being. If we are wise, we simply say, I need to know what you know about me, and I need to know what you want me to do, because I am determined to do exactly that.
Now, selfishness will inhibit that disposition, and pride will keep us from ever humbling ourselves before God. But can't you see how foolish it is, how utterly ridiculous it is for human beings who are contingent creatures? I mean, we are not here by our own devices. And we don't stay here by our power. We're here by the goodness and forbearance of God Almighty. Why, it just makes all kinds of sense to fall upon our faces before Him. We don't get smaller because of that. We get larger and taller and finer as a result. Well, let's do one more this morning. Child abuse in extreme. Consider this contrasting approach to child rearing. Total domination or total permissiveness? Which is worse? Both. Both are terribly wrong. In total domination, when the parent deals with a child like a puppet, puts every word in his mouth or her mouth, moves every limb, makes every decision, never discusses the whys and the wherefores, that child never will learn responsibility. Never can make choices and then be responsible for those choices. And what will happen is that child, even in the adult years, will be terribly immature and unable to deal with life at a mature level. Total domination. And I think the reason for total domination in many instances is selfishness. Now, the only other possibility is foolishness. The thought that you can manipulate your children by simply giving edicts and pronouncing this is how it will be and this is what you will do. You come and ask your mother and father what you're going to do next, and we'll tell you what you're going to do. But on the other hand, total permissiveness is no answer. If you're just totally permissive with your children and believe what one French philosopher, Rousseau, believed. He believed in the noble savage. He thought if we could just go back to the primitive state, that men would just naturally grow up fine and good. Wouldn't have to train them to it. And that infiltrated the educational system. And finally came to this country. The idea if we just let little children have their head, they would naturally do good. And they would naturally learn. Now, there's a capacity for that in little children. But there's also a capacity for the other side. And if they are to become what they are intended to be by God, we'll have to train. There'll have to be guidance and direction. And permissiveness just throws all that to the wind. And we expect something to happen. And, of course, the selfish individual will be delighted with this idea because it doesn't take any real thought and involvement or pain. But this child will be forced to make decisions that he's too immature to make, left on his own devices. And he'll be left in situations that he's too immature to handle because he needs direction. I'm always amused at people that say, I'm not teaching my child about anything in religion. I want him to be able to grow up and choose for himself. Choose what? You've offered him, first of all, no alternatives. And second of all, you've given him no equipment to make a decision about that matter. Unless you believe in your heart that it doesn't matter what you believe.
One English literarist said, if you have a guest in your house who says it doesn't matter what you believe, always count the silverware when he leaves.
Because what we believe and value determines our conduct. And a child who's given no values and no beliefs, and I'm not talking about some sort of existential beliefs. I'm not talking about right and wrong in some sort of mobile fashion that is today it's right, tomorrow it may not be, and today it's wrong, but tomorrow it may not be. I'm talking about transcendent moral principles. I'm talking about principles that have their root in eternity. They do not change because God does not change. And it's out of His wise and majestic counsel that those truths issue. And they will not change unless He changes, and He does not change. Which is one of the great blessings of God. We are so capricious. We are so changeable. But He does not change, ever the same. Truth, absolute. And so these two approaches to child rearing can be hellish. I want to just pause to make an observation, and then we'll make the concluding exhortations. Would you feed your children poison? Well, of course you would not. Would you let them play where poison was easily available? Well, certainly you would not do that. Would you stand and watch them take poison? No. Well, I want to warn you. Out of a certain little electronic box, of which you probably have two and maybe three, there is pouring into this society because of the values that this society has espoused. And because the things that the worst part of us is titillated by, a river of absolute filth. And I want to warn you about turning your children loose to play next to that without any kind of direction and restraint, because it will destroy them. Daily television viewing in this country increased from 1960 to 1992 from 5.06 hours a day to 7.04, while the SAT scores went down 76 points. Illegitimate births increased five times. Violent crimes went up from 16.1 incidents per 100,000 population to 75.8. I'm not telling you that television is the cause of all this. It may be a reflection of it. But why in the world would you want a child of yours to see in a year's time 9,906 incidents of violence, 8,970 incidents of sex, 86% of which is outside of marriage, 16,211 incidents of profanity? The three major networks, without the Fox network included, and Fox has really starred in this area, produce 8 incidents of sex, 9 incidents of violence, and 14 incidents of profanity every hour. Every hour. This medium is a good sales. That's why companies pay millions of dollars to put their advertisements on it. But it peddles illicit sexuality, violence, and greed, materialism. Do not, I say do not, let your children be reared by television and maintain the kind of discipline in that direction that will guide them and train them in values that are fine. Don't believe the nonsense that all this is just froth that will have no effect, and it'll be like sticking your hand in water. There will be no impact. There will be an impact. Especially in a vacuum of moral training. But even then, there's a contradiction in us. When we urge them to speak purely, when we urge them to treat marriage with the highest regard and reverence, and to keep themselves sexually pure until they can come and make a lifelong commitment, to another human being in marriage. And train them to be gentle with others, to be thoughtful of others, and then unleash upon them all this contradiction. Will they understand? Finally, these rules. That I believe may help balance training. Set boundaries for your children. They want them. They need them. They will resist them. That is exactly what children are supposed to do. And your task and responsibility is to set the boundaries and to be consistent about them. Here's what you may and here's what you may not do. Here's what will be approved here. Here's what will not be approved here. It is your task. You say, but sometimes it is onerous and your children are resentful and they rebel against it. I know, that's what children will do. And it is your task to redirect that attitude. And it will not be achieved by simply breaking down all the boundaries and flying off in some wild, loose, uncaring way. And then secondly, allow the child freedom within those boundaries. Don't be constantly hovering over. Let the child act in those areas you have permitted him to act in. And rejoice in that. And enjoy the child. And commend the child when he has done well. Be quick to commend the good things. There is no better power on earth for altering human behavior than positive reinforcement. Sometimes there is the necessity of negative reinforcement. But positive reinforcement is a powerful influence in influencing behavior. And as children grow, help them to see that the boundaries you are setting in their lives are not yours, but God's. That transference has got to be made. You're not going to be here forever. External control is no way to guide human behavior. And so it's imperative that they understand that you are choosing to guide them by rules that you did not conceive nor construct, but that come from God. And as children mature, loosen the apron strings. Enlarge the realms in which they're going to make choices. They're going to be responsible for the choices. And the consequence of those choices are sometimes going to be difficult. But do not, I repeat this, do not be too quick to take away the consequences of a bad choice by a child. I have a friend who left his child over some days to stay in a jail. When he could have gone down and paid everything and gotten him out. But that young lad needed to learn the consequences of behavior. And he did. I mean, he ridded it. And he came out a wiser young man who behaved himself thereafter in a most prudent manner and is doing good and serving others well. Never, ever give your child permission to do what is wrong. Never. Even if he chooses wrong in that period of his life when the apron strings have been loosened and there is a greater area of choice, when he chooses the wrong, just let the child know. I do not approve your decision. It is not right. Your father, your mother will never say or accept such behavior for themselves or in you. We have higher hopes for you than that. Never give permission to do wrong. Never defend your child when the child is wrong. Always defend your child when the child is right. And never give them any cause to question that you love them. And I want to tell you something. All that permissive kind of love that you think one day is going to cause your children to rise up and call you blessed, that is a myth. They will not bless you. Your permissiveness will have created a situation in them that's miserable for them psychologically and emotionally and spiritually, and will create misery and agony in your life and the lives of others. Love them. Guide and nurture them. Be patient, but be insistent on right principles. Never, ever punish them. That is, attack them. Always, always address your discipline to the behavior that is wrong. And always say to them that you are capable, and we know it, of better things. We have greater confidence in you than this. That is to say, we believe that what you have done is not representative of what is fine inside of you, and we hold up those ideals still and urge you to keep them. And last of all, and I didn't make another transparency for this, pray to God, because you and I are not going to be perfect parents. And fortunately, we don't have to be perfect. But if we're wise enough to love God ourselves and to teach what God has said, not as some suggestions, but as those lasting, unchanging principles of life, and if we have provided for, nurtured, and cared for these children, they will someday say to us, with great respect, we appreciate so much what you did. And I want to tell you, parents who allow their children to treat them with contempt are not doing any favors for those children. But respect is earned over time. First demanded as children learn to respect their parents, and then finally to respect God and others. But at last, it is granted willingly and gladly by the child who has been brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Well, that's what I wanted to say, and I
said it. And now, I have to ask you if you're the kind of person who can rear children in the right way. If you have escaped selfishness by coming to know God and by committing yourself to serve Him in His Son, Jesus Christ. If you've understood the cross, that canceled I, that renounced self, that disposition that says, not what I will, but what you will. Whose concern is always and evermore, not for self, but for others. And the willingness is in you to yield whatever might be pleasant for you on behalf of the needs of other people. And you can't do that by yourself. The only way to be crucified and relieved of that selfishness is to accept the Christ on the cross and to follow Him as He guides and teaches us that way. Have you believed in Him? Have you confessed Him as Savior? Imperative. If you refuse to confess Him as Lord openly, He says plainly He will confess that He does not know you. And have you been baptized into Him? Simple, clear instruction of the Lord Jesus Himself and of His apostles and the illustrations of it in the book of Acts by Luke are apparent and clear and cannot be controverted by the honest soul. Here it is, faith that moves us to commitment, that changes our hearts and causes us to renounce ourselves and to affirm God and His will in everything, and then to be baptized into Him, buried with Him. Buried in the fluid grave as He was buried in the earth. And then raised, as Paul says in Romans chapter 6, to walk in newness of life. And if as a parent, as an individual, as a prospective parent, you haven't been behaving well, now's the time to get it straight. Little children are dependent upon you. Others are dependent upon you. They need you. They need you with your head straight and your heart straight. They need you committed to God so that they can learn how to be committed to God.
And so let us resolve that we're going to do that by the help of God. And may He overrule any of our failures and guide those children in the ways everlasting. We're going to sing an invitation hymn. It's our custom here. And the purpose is to invite anyone who wants to come and confess Jesus and to be baptized into Him, to become a disciple, to come. And if there's a brother or sister whose wrong has been of such a nature, of a public sort, who needs to make that kind of public correction, having first sought mercy and forgiveness from his Father, then this is an opportunity extended to you while we're standing and singing.